From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And today there are conflicting reports about whether the government of Yemen is demanding that the U.S. halt ground operations against terrorists there. That's one of many questions around last month's ground raid by U.S. Special Forces in Yemen, in which a Navy SEAL was killed along with several al-Qaeda militants and many Yemeni women and children. Planning for the mission started during the Obama administration, but it was authorized by President Trump after he took office, and the White House insists it was a success. Greg Myrie is NPR's national security correspondent. And Greg, we know the Yemeni government is upset because of these civilian deaths. So tell us what we know they're saying.
Right. They are upset, as you noted. It seems they feel that we did reach a Yemeni official who said that they're looking at a reassessment, not a ban or suspension. But they are upset, particularly about the civilian casualties here. Two very quick points. Ground raids by the U.S. in Yemen are very, very rare, so it's not something we see very often. And when we say the government in Yemen, important to remember, President Hadi and his government was chased out of the country to Saudi Arabia 2 years ago. And that's where they're operating from. So the government in Yemen is a very loose term.
Well, yes. And well, what would it mean, though, if whatever is the voice that comes out of Yemen does say, you know, the U.S. is banned from ground raids?
Well, again, we're looking at one or two of these a year in recent years. Drone strikes are what are much more common. It was 38 last year by the U.S. by one count. What is important, I think, is the security cooperation between the U.S. Military and Yemen's President Hadi. And the U.S. does need help on the ground with intelligence. So that level of cooperation, I think, is the key thing to be watching.
We'll talk about the decision-making process because there's been questions here as well. We understand a cover of darkness was needed, a moonless night. And there were reports that that's why the Obama administration did not proceed and why the Trump White House did. They got that moonless night. But there have been questions about how the Trump administration made this decision. So what are they?
Yeah, I mean, this is something that really goes back at least until November. It's something the military wanted to do. It was their plan. They worked it up through the chain of command, through Obama officials at the White House. And then it came down to you were getting close to a possible operation. And as you mentioned, the military wanted a moonless night. And the next one was going to fall after Obama left office on January 20th and Trump came in. So it seems the Obama White House didn't want to make a decision one way or the other that would tie Trump's hands. And then it was ultimately Trump who made the decision to go forward with this raid.
And how does it affect the Trump administration, especially Donald Trump's promise to be more aggressive than President Obama in fighting terrorism?
Right. I mean, and Yemen seems to be a place that they're taking a very strong stand on and have had has come up on several occasions already. So, again, it will depend, I think, whether the U.S. can maintain a good working relationship with President Hadi and his fighters, even if he has limited political control there, in terms of how much the U.S. Can do in Yemen. And again, just one of several places where President Trump has talked about what he wants to do. He's also called for a new comprehensive plan against ISIS for within 30 days. So he's working on several fronts.
And what are you hearing? You know, this is the kind of thing that gets hashed out. These are critical decisions. We saw that picture of the Obama White House huddled in a room watching hand over mouth the attack to get Osama bin Laden. What are you hearing? Is there a sense that perhaps the Trump administration was too quick on the draw, maybe needs to get, you know, figure out a little bit more of the layout of the land, or this was just one of those things?
Yeah, I wouldn't read too much into one raid. Again, mm-hmm. This was something the military had planned and the military carried out, and it required a presidential approval. So the same thing could have happened under Obama. It could mm-hmm. have happened differently. It could not have happened at all. So I wouldn't read too much into it, but I do think we are going to see a White House that is still trying to figure out some of the things that it's going to do and how it's going to do it, but does have plans to be very aggressive in terms of going after extremists.
And very briefly, Greg, what does President Trump's inclusion of Yemen on the travel ban mean for those relations that you said would be important?
I think that's also part of this. That's also one of the reasons the Yemenis are angry. They're not happy about that either, and that's going to be part of the equation.
Yeah. Greg Myrie, NPR national security correspondent. Greg, thank you.
My pleasure, Robin.
Well, there's no doubt that President Trump had the authority to order the ground raid in Yemen, but his authority to ban travel from seven majority Muslim countries is under question. A federal judge put the president's order on hold, and yesterday an appeals court heard arguments in the case. We're waiting for the results of that case. And speaking at a gathering of sheriffs in Washington today, President Trump denounced the arguments against his executive order as, quote, disgraceful.
I don't ever want to call a court biased, so I won't call it biased. And we haven't had a decision yet. But courts seem to be so political, and it would be so great for our justice system if they would be able to read a statement and do what's right. And that has to do with the security of our country, which is so important.
President Trump has also taken to Twitter to criticize the federal judge that put a stay on his order. And all this is leading many to worry about a constitutional crisis. Joining us now is Bruce Ackerman, professor of law and political science at Yale. He's also the author of many books that focus on constitutional law and public policy. Professor, welcome back.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well. And setting aside the arguments over the president's executive order, what do you think about what he's been saying about courts, about judges, especially calling a federal judge, James Robart, a so-called judge?
Well, you see, many presidents have disagreed with opinions once they have been rendered. Mr. Trump is assaulting the integrity of the judicial system when he is trying to intimidate judges while they're deciding the case. This is unprecedented and an assault on the fundamental principles of judicial independence. And it's especially worrying because the internal checks on the executive branch, the traditional watchdogs of legality in the of the executive branch, have been politicized and transformed into clever lawyers who are willing to present legal arguments for almost anything that the president wants to do. So the traditional watchdog of legality in the executive branch is the Office of Legal Counsel. The Office of Legal Counsel should have spent some time thinking about the fundamental issues raised by the president's order. It simply rubber-stamped it.
Well, what about the idea that this is going to lead to a constitutional crisis? Explain what that is exactly, and do you think that this is leading to a constitutional crisis?
Yes, it is already leading to a crisis. What we have here is the erosion of the internal checks executive legality, both in the Office of Legal Counsel, and we already have the appointment of a White House counsel who was President Trump's lawyer for the campaign. So he is a very substantial lawyer, but he is a partisan. He is going to be spending all his time trying to elaborate why whatever the president wants to do is legal. So that means that President Trump is going to do things in the world, exploit the fact that his lawyers say it's legal, and then change the status quo, and then force Congress and the courts and the American people to react. Well, this places intense pressure on these other institutions, and especially the courts. The time and again, if President Trump tries to condemn the courts. For example, on Sunday, he said, "I just can't believe a judge would put our country in such peril. If something happens, blame him and the court system." He's saying, if there is a terrorist attack, you shouldn't blame me. You should blame the courts.
Right. And he's also gone after the media on that front as well, and said that the media would be to blame.
This is really the talk of a demagogue. And there should be no hesitation. This is not something that an a president who is supposed to be, you know, mindful of his responsibilities under the Constitution as interpreted by judges and respectful of the Congress of the United States should engage in. And this is only the beginning, of course. You see, and I'm very concerned if this is simply going to be repeated time and time again.
I think we're going to have to keep watching, and we're going to have to leave it there. Bruce Ackerman, sure. Professor of Law and Political Science at Yale, thanks so much for joining us.
Sure. Thank you.
Our next guest says if you want to understand Russia, look to the Bolshoi Ballet, which had its beginnings when America did in 1776. Part of its storied history, the ballet Swan Lake, which premiered at the Bolshoi in 1877, but it was a flop. Fast forward to the modern era, there was that acid attack that nearly blinded the Bolshoi Ballet's director 4 years ago. The drama offstage at the Bolshoi often rivals that onstage. Princeton music professor Simon Morrison says the acid attack was not an aberration. The Bolshoi's often been in turmoil, and he says the same could be said for Russia itself. He's written a new book titled Bolshoi Confidential, Secrets of the Russian Ballet from the Rule of the Tsars to Today. Professor Simon, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
And let's distinguish, because Americans may know the Kirov Ballet in St. Petersburg. Defectors like Nureyev and Baryshnikov came to the U.S. You're talking about the Bolshoi in Moscow. Is it fair to characterize the Kirov as more classical and the Bolshoi as more, dramatic?
I would say so. And I'd say that because the choreographer Marius Petipa, who is really regarded broadly as the greatest choreographer of all time in terms of classical ballet, he was lodged in St. Petersburg for most of his career. He was in Paris, Spain, briefly in Moscow, but he spent most of his career, 60 years of it, in St. Petersburg. And he created, you know, numerous masterpieces that define the canon. And he was somebody who consolidated and defined classical strictures in dance. Whereas the Bolshoi, you know, in the South was a theater that was more influenced by Italian traditions than the French traditions associated with Petipa. It put on wilder entertainments. It was more showy. It's still considered to be more showy in style. The dancers are more bravura. And it never sort of lost that kind of vaudevillian, you know, entertaining, crowd-pleasing affect.
Well, when it comes to, you know, being more explosive or showy or however you might put it, you have this acid attack, reportedly because of grudges over bonuses that were paid for solo dancers. How is the now former director, Sergei Filin? Is he okay?
Mm-hmm. I wouldn't say he's okay. He's largely blind in one eye. I think 95% of the vision is gone in one eye. And in the other eye, he's, I think, down to about 50% vision. And he commented that for him, looking outside, you know, looking at the world is sort of like looking through cellophane. You know, in the end, he was so badly compromised by this injury, which was truly barbaric, that it was not possible for him to continue his duties. He was, you know, considered to be a conflicted and compromised character. And even after this attack, there were still people who actually thought negatively of him. And so, you know, there was no way he could continue in the position.
It fits with one of your descriptions of the Bolshoi. It's the Bolshoi's past, but it, you know, this fit of emotion, this violent emotion, fits with your writing that the Bolshoi's past is one of remarkable achievements interrupted and even fueled by periodic bouts of madness, which mirror Russia's own history. How so?
Well, one of the things, when I wrote this book, I was actually amazed by how great masterpieces like Swan Lake, like Romeo and Juliet, were created almost despite terrible political pressures. And that was the case of Romeo and Juliet, which was a ballet that was censored by the state. It originally had a happy ending, and then it was reconfigured to more accurately reflect Shakespeare, the source tragedy. Swan Lake had to be reconfigured several times before it became the masterpiece that most people know and love. And I thought it's amazing how this theater managed, despite itself, despite its internal conflicts, despite political pressures, despite the fact that ballet in Moscow was certainly regarded as a sort of second-tier, more salacious entertainment compared to opera, despite the fact that there was a dearth of Russian homegrown talent, it managed to produce these great works. And then by the time I'd finished the book, I'd come to the reverse conclusion, which was that, in fact, because of these pressures, it actually produced these works. And it was almost a sense that the artists, the great artists of the Bolshoi past and present, could take any sort of ideological dreck in the, say, 20th century, in the Soviet period, and actually turn that into artistic magic or gold.
Well, talking more about how the country and the core are so bound, the Soviet Union was signed into existence at the Bolshoi in 1922. And you write that Russians knew that something really bad happened whenever a tape of the ballerina Maya Plisetskaya dancing Swan Lake was shown on TV?
Yes, Swan Lake became the emblem of the state. And so during the August Putsch in 1991, when Boris Yeltsin ended up taking power and the Soviet Union dissolved, in and around those events, during those 3 days in August, when the country was in turmoil, the Soviet Union was falling apart definitively, that ballet was shown on an endless loop. And I will say, interestingly, that the reverse happened during the recent 2013 takeover of Crimea. To protest that event, Ukrainians in Crimea actually trotted out a bunch of adolescent dancers to actually dance part of Swan Lake, mm-hmm. and they put that on YouTube for everyone to see. So it's still, you know, I think as one of my reviewers put out, when Swan Lake is on TV, you know that there's something afoot in the Kremlin.
Well, I mean, it's just fascinating, the intersection. You mentioned that at one point the Bolsheviks declared that Romeo and Juliet couldn't have this, you know, double suicide as an ending. But they also ordered that Swan Lake has to have a happy ending. The gypsy ballet Esmeralda became Esmeralda, Daughter of the People. So there's mm-hmm. a constant intersection.
Absolutely. These works were recoded. You know, the original Swan Lake, which was done in 1877, was by all accounts a flop. It didn't look good. It didn't sound good. And in Moscow, because this theater was, again, you know, a sort of mass entertainment forum, the ending of the work was all about the special effects, creating a flood on stage, wind machines. And in the Soviet period, because it was reconfigured as a sort of aristocratic pageant in which, in fact, young love defeats the aristocratic order, if you will, then it was all important to have this kind of more brilliant apotheosis, suggesting a starry beyond. And that's the same thing that happened with Romeo and Juliet. This sort of optimistic tragedy idea was imposed on these works.
Hmm. Well, it's just fascinating to read the history of a ballet along with the history of a country. I mean, here's just some details you give us. The ballet continued during the Russian Revolution, but on the morning of the revolution, there was a sign that said, no rehearsal on account of the revolution. The next day, another sign read, bloodless revolution, performance canceled still. At one point, the look of the dancers changed to a more muscular, assertive, revolutionary style that still exists. Two dancers once committed suicide by falling onto the stage during a performance of the Red Poppy, which you call the first Soviet ballet. But what would you say the Bolshoi tells us about Russia today? We started by talking about that acid attack.
It's certainly recovered from this incident. There's a new artistic director for the ballet. Vazayev is his last name. And right now, where there is among sort of the educated classes, you know, some dissatisfaction with the authoritarianism under which everybody lives there, you know, a sense that maybe more experimentalism in art, which could point the way towards greater liberalization, that's taking place outside of these big institutions, which are kind of creaking under their own weight. And maybe, you know, the visual arts or other forms of media will actually be the place where true, you know, a new kind of revolutionary thought might take place.
Well, so you're a close watcher of the Bolshoi, but you're also mm-hmm. a close watcher of President Putin. And we just wondered, you know, your thoughts on the current state of U.S.-Russia relations, the claim that Russia gathered compromising information during the election to interfere with the election. Mm-hmm. And is there any way that somehow either intersects with the Bolshoi or will be, you know, there are some sort of tea leaves to read in the Bolshoi today? I mean, is there any intersection there?
Basically, there's a sort of cloud of confusion on both sides with regard to this issue. And although officially You know, in the media, state media, Donald Trump is being celebrated, you know, and, you know, Russians think, you know, he'll be a good president, you know. There's a lot of people actually, and this is a sad and poignant thing. There's a lot of people on the street there who actually look at the current situation and think about Orwell in 1984. And there was an anecdote I was told by the reporter Sonia Kishkovsky over there that she went to a manicurist in Moscow on the weekend, and she said, "I'm alarmed by Donald Trump," you know, this Russian citizen. And she said, "Well, why are you alarmed by Donald Trump?" And she said, "Well, have you read George Orwell's 1984? And Sonia said, "Yeah, but a long time ago. What exactly are you referring to?" And she said, and then she, the manicurist, started to cry. And she said, "Well, he surrenders." And the point she was making is that the United States surrendered to the same kind of, like, truthiness and, alternate facts and all the rest of it that have actually been, you know, the curse of Russian society for many years now.
Huh. Cue some dramatic music and picture people dancing it out. That's Princeton University music professor Simon Morrison, author of Bolshoi Confidential, Secrets of the Russian Ballet, From the Rule of the Tsars to Today. It is a deep read. Professor Simon, thank you so much.
Great pleasure. Thank you.
This podcast and the following message are sponsored by Poo-Pourri, the original before-you-go toilet spray that uses essential oils to trap bathroom odor beneath the surface of the water. Use it next time you have to go at work or when visiting family and friends. Poo-Pourri allows you to go anywhere with uplifting, natural fragrances like lemongrass, lavender, or hibiscus. Whether at work, on a date, even at a party, you can go. Use the code NOW and get 20% off your next purchase at poopourri.com.
The Financial Times is reporting today that Amazon is now refocusing its effort to sell books in print. Americans read more books on actual paper than e-books, and print book sales are rising. As of today, the Amazon bestsellers are Neil Gaiman's Norse Mythology, The Handmaiden's Tale by Margaret Atwood, and 1984 by George Orwell. But it can still feel intimidating sometimes to pick up a book. So Harvard Business Review is out with some advice, and Kurt Nikisch, senior editor there, joins us now. Hi, Kurt.
Hey, Jeremy.
So according to the Pew Research Center, Americans read an average of 12 books a year. And if you want to increase that, the Harvard Business Review says you should start by moving your TV.
Yeah. So picture this book that you want to read on your coffee table, but it's got the TV remote on top of that. What are you going to do when you come home for work or get done with dinner? If you're finding that you end up sort of going to your phone to see social media or you turn it on to see the news, well, maybe you just need to move your TV to a room where it's not the default option.
Not have that competition between the book and the TV.
Right. It's like cookies next to the salad.
Okay. Another piece of advice, make a public commitment. What does that mean?
Yeah. So the same way that people say on Facebook they're going to lose so many pounds or they join a walking group, you can use that same behavior to just tell people, I'm reading this book, or I just finished this book, or I'm going to do this. If you make reading part of your identity, it's just much easier to make it a habit and break other ones.
It might just make it more difficult for the other people because they see that you're racing through all of these books and they're thinking they're not doing as well as maybe they should.
They can join you.
Well, how do you decide what books to read?
Yeah, so this is where it often is complicating, and people walk into a bookstore. I mean, 50,000 books are published each year, right? Mm. On top of this amazing library that's already there. It's kind of like walking into a wine store, and you're like, oh my goodness, where do I begin? Mm. Well, listen to other people that you like, people who you find interesting. Find out what they're reading. You talked to Tim Ferriss on the show today. He publishes a reading list. Mm. Bill Gates has a reading list. There's a podcaster I like, Mike Duncan. He podcasts about history, and he talks about books that kind of go deeper into the issues that he's talking about. So find things, find the people and the threads that sort of spark your curiosity and use that as your way into these libraries.
And NPR is a great resource as well. They've got great lists on their website, npr.org. If you don't like the book, should you quit or push through?
Quit it. I mean, so many people stop reading because they're kind of not into that book anymore, but then it just sits there, makes them feel guilty. The other thing is, don't just quit reading the book, like get it out of your bookshelf, make room for something else, give it to somebody else, and just move on to the next one. You only have so many books in your life.
There's also advice that you give for people who want to read much more, like one book a week. What can they do?
Yeah, so fiction's different. You really need to immerse yourself into that world. But for nonfiction books, your goal is not actually to read the book, it's to understand it. And you probably don't need to read it all to understand it. You can skim each chapter. You can get the ideas, understand the arguments, and, you know, and then maybe you find out it's so interesting you read the whole thing, but you can move through books a lot more quickly if you just have the goal of understanding them rather than reading them.
That's Kurt Nikisch, senior editor at Harvard Business Review, and we'll link you to their list of things you could do if you want to read more books at hereandnow.org. Kurt, thank you.
Jeremy, my pleasure.
Uber says it has more than 160,000 drivers in the U.S. and more than a million worldwide. The company doesn't release data about how many of those drivers work full-time and how many are just picking up rides as a side gig. But that's what the company wants. They helped coin the phrase the gig economy, and they pitch independence, as in this ad from 2014.
Around the globe, Uber is empowering people to be their own boss.
You can run your business the way you want,
without having to give up on what matters most.
But according to a new report from Bloomberg, that's not always the reality. Two reporters for Bloomberg found many Uber drivers sleep in their cars or cheap hostels to stay close to where the fares are. Many have seen their earnings drop in recent years, and some are struggling to make ends meet, according to the story by Eric Newcomer and Olivia Zaleski, who joins us now. Olivia, these are not homeless Uber drivers. They have homes, but you say they're sleeping in their cars to go elsewhere?
Yes, what we found are several Uber drivers across the country. We interviewed drivers in San Francisco, Chicago, Los Angeles, San Diego, New York, that are driving into high-density areas where there's surge pricing and spending several nights at a time because they can't afford to live in these cities, but they want to get the surge pricing in these cities. It's supply and demand. So if there's less supply and more demand, the drivers will make more money and they will live in their cars for up to 2 weeks at a time, we found.
And we mentioned that you found that their earnings are dropping. That's because across the board, Uber has lowered the price of the fares over the last few years.
They have. What we found is that drivers were making about $19.35 on average an hour in 2015. And now they're making, on average, about $15.58 an hour. Now, it's unclear exactly if that's because Uber has taken action to lower the fares. That's contributed to the issue. But also, there are a lot more drivers on the road now, and that affects the supply and demand equation that I mentioned.
Right. There's more competition. They even have other companies,
right.
Lyft and such. Well, you spoke with an economics professor, Paul Oyer of Stanford, who said Uber drivers are essentially immigrants now. They're searching for the better wages that you mentioned that they then take home to their local economies when they do go home. But as you pointed out, they can often spend weeks away from home. They stay at hostels. They park in parking lots. Tell us about Andre Williams. He's a driver you met from Sacramento.
Yeah, Andre, incredible personality and really hardworking man. He has a son in Sacramento. He drives in 2 hours every 2 weeks to high-density San Francisco, and he'll work about 14 to 16 hours a day. You could tell he felt a great sense of pride that he was working so much. He was proud of himself that he was able to take care of his son and feed his family and give them a better life.
Well, and many of the drivers you speak to do feel this way, that this is, they see this as an opportunity. They're at the 7-Eleven off the JFK Expressway in Queens, at the Walmart off the Jack Nicklaus Freeway in Columbus, Ohio. There's another 7-Eleven in Chicago's Lincoln Park neighborhood that drivers call the Uber Terminal. That's where they're sleeping in cars.
That was the most remarkable part of reporting this story, is in speaking with so many drivers. I mean, I can't lie. I went into it assuming that many of them would feel resentful or angry towards Uber. I was quite the opposite. Many of them said they felt that they were running their own business. They didn't want to go back to their previous jobs where they weren't allowed to work more hours because the hours that they could work was capped. And they felt like they had more control in this job. We were not expecting that because it is on the exterior, you know, a rather bleak and depressing looking situation to think of somebody sleeping in their car for 2 weeks at a time just to make ends meet.
Well, but the critics of Uber would say that this is something that Uber doesn't like publicized. And you write that Uber doesn't say publicly that half of the driving gets done by people who work more than 35 hours a week. They generate about half of Uber's revenue, responsible for about half of Uber's trips. Because Uber has been selling the notion that this is something that you can just do for a few hours a week.
Right. I mean, absolutely. It's a very uncomfortable situation for them because what they shared with us is that more than 60% of Uber drivers only work 10 hours a week, but the majority of the driving, and that's the majority of the income that comes into Uber, is done by drivers who work over 35 hours a week. So it's done by full-time drivers.
And of course, this becomes important information because critics say they are being abused. They're not getting benefits. They're not being treated like real employees.
That exactly. And we did speak with some labor advocates who felt very strongly that they are taking advantage of workers by not classifying them as full-time employees. One of the most interesting parts of their argument was that they said it creates a tremendous amount of instability to have a gig economy where there's surge pricing because people are always chasing a better fare. Mm-hmm. And therefore, they don't take the time that they need to rest, the time that they need to be with their families, and it creates a lot of instability that extends well beyond just the driver, but extends to their families and their children.
Well, I was going to ask you about that. I mean, they may say that they're happy doing this, and that's, you know, obviously their right, but does it become a problem if they are working 16 hours straight and sleeping in a car and then driving people around?
Well, it's certainly not safe. I mean, I can imagine that you don't get a great night's sleep if you're doing that night after night.
Well, and you spoke to Uber's head of driver experience. This person told you he personally hadn't spoken to someone that slept in the car, but the company has declared 2017 will be the year of the driver. Meaning what? I mean, what might they come up with to address this, the fact that drivers are driving so many hours?
I think they're still figuring out how to deal with this issue. What's important is they did acknowledge it, and they said that they want to do something about it. But one thing that Lyft does that maybe is a direction that Uber could go in is they cap their drivers. Their drivers are not allowed to work more than 14 hours in a row. After 14 hours, the Lyft app requires that drivers take a six-hour break to get some rest.
And they sort of can't do anymore until they
it shuts off.
Right. Well, we'll keep an eye on this story. Olivia Zaleski reported it along with Eric Newcomer for Bloomberg. Olivia, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
And by the way, we reached out to Uber for a response. We haven't heard back yet. But if you are an Uber driver, happy or not happy about sleeping in your car, I think I've been in one of those cars, leave a comment with this story at hearnow.org. Quick check of the weather's wake. Governor John Bel Edwards has declared a state of emergency as southeastern Louisiana residents pick up the pieces after that flurry of powerful tornadoes ripped through New Orleans yesterday. We'll post a video shot by NASA employees at New Orleans' Michoud manufacturing plant of a tornado rolling across the horizon, five employees injured. The storm flipped cars, destroyed homes, left thousands without power, injured at least 40 people across seven Louisiana parishes. Amazing no one was killed. For more, let's bring in the Weather Channel's Maria La Rosa. Maria, we don't think of tornadoes in New Orleans. What happened here?
Well, we don't think of tornadoes typically in February either, but we actually have a little bump in, on average, every year around February when it comes to severe weather. So while it seems unusual, when you look at February any given year, there's always that chance, especially along the Gulf Coast. And for New Orleans, all the ingredients were there. We had the warmth, the moisture, the wind shear, powerful low up to the north that was helping to trigger all of that. What made it somewhat unusual was the time of day. This was pretty early in the day, not in the warmth of an afternoon or evening. So in that regard, this was a little bit unusual.
Well, look, here in the Boston area, people had a surprise this morning. There was a freezing rain at about 5 a.m. People stepped out their doors and fell. I mean, people fell. We have a colleague who broke her arm. The emergency rooms are filled with people who just fell. We're going to be 60 degrees this afternoon and then a foot of snow tomorrow. It's crazy. But what about this atmospheric river that's brought rain to the West Coast, Northern California?
Well, what's pretty amazing is the storm that'll be underway in cities like Boston has that connection to the Pacific, and all of the onslaught of storms that they've seen recently, it has its origins back there. But yes, it's going to continue. The pattern's not changing. And unfortunately, we have at least another 2 days or so where cities like San Francisco will continue to see heavy rainfall. All the rivers in the region are full, if not flooding already. So there's nothing to cut it short just yet. They will see a very much needed and deserved break come the weekend, where pretty much the entire West Coast gets a chance to dry out, not just one day, but for 2 days and really take a breather from all of this.
Okay, look forward to that. Maria La Rosa, meteorologist with the Weather Channel. Maria, thanks so much.
No problem.
Parts of California are more worried this year about flooding than drought after major storms have hit the state. In fact, today, many parts of Northern California are seeing more rain and snow. The increased precipitation has been good news for California's agricultural industry. But after years of drought, and even before the drought, some farmers have started to do their work differently, employing techniques to clean soil in an effort to use less water and to help clean the air. Ezra David Romero from Valley Public Radio explains.
15 years ago, tractors could be heard at Sano Farms on any given day. Now the sound of tractors is a rare occurrence on this farm about an hour west of Fresno. That's because the 4,000-acre tomato and almond farm has just about stopped running tractors. Farm manager Jesse Sanchez says he used to think it was a good idea to turn the soil often.
Years ago, we used to have 28 tractors working.
Not anymore.
This year, when 2-3 tractors, I do all the work.
Did you sell all your old tractors, or were you leasing them?
We sold them. We don't want to see them no more.
Right? Sanchez is a proponent of enhancing soil health. He's been at it for 15 years. He tills a lot less, plants cover crops like mustard greens when tomatoes aren't in season, and he buries drip tape so plants have a direct water source. The result? He uses a third less water, uses 75% less diesel to fuel tractors, and he cut back on fertilizers. And according to the California Department of Food and Agriculture, his farm could be a model for other growers. Sanchez and USDA soil scientist Tony Rolfs are measuring the soil's health by piercing the ground with a metal tube. Sanchez stabs the ground with a hollow pipe to check the soil health in a field of mustard greens.
You see the soil? It's not compacted.
You're smelling the soil. What do you smell?
One of the tests for soil health is the actual smell.
Oh, how is soil supposed to smell?
You like the smell.
Soil smells like potting mix.
And yeah. If it's bad soil health, you get a sour, putrid smell.
Sanchez says the healthier the soil is, the greater chance plants have to thrive. They produce more and even yield tastier fruits and veggies. At Sano Farms, soil organic matter has grown from about 0.5% to 3%. That's the living part of soil that turns dying plants into minerals needed by growing plants.
It's like when you have plenty good bacteria in your stomach, you digest the food a lot better. Same thing with the soil. More bacteria that you have is going to give you better results.
It's not just large-scale farmers like Sanchez that utilize climate-friendly farming techniques. Retired organic farmer Tom Willey used similar approaches on his farm in Madera and says the general public should understand why soil health is so important.
It's the survival of our species. I mean, the soil is the thin skin of the earth that we all exist on. Our lives are bound up in the health and the productivity of the soil.
This kind of farming isn't widely accepted, although many farmers have some kind of healthy soils practice in play. That's because many can't necessarily afford to change their practices all at once. It took both Sanchez and Willie 15 years or more to get where they're at today. But that could change with help from the state. California Department of Food and Agriculture Deputy Secretary Jenny Lester Moffitt says the state has allotted $7.5 million to incentivize California farmers to further improve soil health and to reduce greenhouse gas emissions.
This is a great opportunity to allow us to build up a program to work with growers on incentivizing these practices and hopefully make the case for more funding in the future as well.
The program is expected to roll out later this year. Growers will have the opportunity to get soil health-related farm projects funded, and the CDFA hopes to set up a few sample projects to help convince farmers that the investment is worth it. This is a big win for air quality, says Bernarda Brillinger with the California Climate and Agriculture Network. Her group backs the Healthy Soils Initiative and lobbied for the project.
We'd like to see it grow, but we also look forward to seeing what the appropriate level is depending on the demand. So it's a bit of a chicken and egg question.
Back on the farm, Jesse Sanchez and Tony Rolfs are testing soil health in another field covered with mustard greens. Rolfs running through a checklist he uses at farms across the state. He's looking for moisture and soil density.
With just some water, put it in a cup, we'll try it, and then we'll just put a little bit of the soil aggregate into the water to see if it stays together. This one's holding together pretty well.
Rolfs gives the soil a score of above average. He's now looking for things crawling in the dirt.
Oh, there's a worm. All right, so we'll give it a 3 on worms, too.
That score is what soil scientists like Rolf want to see at farms across California. Sano Farms is ahead of the times when it comes to farming that benefits the environment. But that could change once the state's Healthy Soils Initiative breaks ground. Until then, farmers can find similar resources from the USDA's Natural Resources Conservation Service. For Here and Now, I'm Ezra David Romero.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.